This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Berkeley Life Nitric Oxide Support Supplements. Nitric oxide is a vital signaling molecule in cardiovascular health. We all make nitric oxide in our bodies, but as we age, it starts to diminish naturally. Being proactive in maintaining nitric oxide levels is vital for healthful aging because an underperforming cardiovascular system will limit the effectiveness of any other supplementation in your regimen. Just two capsules of Berkeley Life daily provides the dietary nitrate equivalent of 7 ounces of beets and can support energy levels, maintain healthy blood pressure levels, and improve general circulation. It's the professional-grade nitric oxide supplement that I recommend and prescribe for my patients. This is only available from healthcare providers. To get your Berkeley Life professional supplements, just go to drhoffman.com/Berkeley Life. That's drhoffman.com/Berkeley Life. You can also get Berkeley Life's patented nitric oxide test strips to conveniently test your own nitric oxide levels safely and easily at home. That's drhoffman.com/Berkeley Life for Berkeley Life nitric oxide supplements. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today's guest is Nina Teichel. She's a journalist who became an advocate opposed to the mainstream nutritional principle, the dumbed-down notion that saturated fat is unhealthy and should be minimized in the American diet. And when we initially scheduled this podcast a couple of months ago, little did we know that we'd be in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. And lest we think that our discussion today is secondary, that it's not relevant, we could proceed with the discussion and say, well, you know, cardiovascular disease, main cause of death in America, coronavirus is but a blip on the statistics. We're not going to do that because coronavirus is a clear and present danger, and it really is subject A these days and will be for some time to come. But there is real relevance to this discussion. And I'm going to share with you, Nina, the opinion of the Canadian Dietetics Association about the relevance of coronavirus to diet. They have a position paper on their website, and their position paper poses this question: can I boost my immune system through my diet? And what they say, this is the official position of the Canadian Dietitians Association. Simply put, you cannot, quote, boost your immune system through diet, and no specific food supplement or natural health product will prevent you from catching COVID-19. And they continue by saying the bottom line is that a healthy diet rich in fruits and vegetables, protein foods, and whole grains is important for a strong immune system. You know, they're not going to make any extravagant claims about diet. Let me just give a little bit about your background, Nina. Nina has been a reporter for National Public Radio. She became a freelancer, contributing to publications including the New York Times, the Washington Post, New Yorker. She's been everywhere. Her 2014 book is sensational. I first interviewed her then about the big fat surprise, why butter, meat, and cheese belong in a healthy diet. And since then, she's contributed to the debate about whether our current dietary guidelines are obsolete, anachronistic, and ultimately undermining the health of Americans. So take it from there, Nina. Diet not relevant to the coronavirus pandemic? What say you?
Well, thank you for having me on your show, first of all. And
it's always a pleasure.
And you put out a lot there. I would say definitely diet is relevant to the COVID-19 pandemic. We are seeing now a number of statistics that show that people who are metabolically unwell, that is to say people with cardiac heart disease or diabetes or just obesity, are people who are dying at higher rates from COVID-19. And they all have the same metabolic dysfunction that leads to all of these diseases. And it is true that diet is what drives these diseases and therefore also drives their immune health. So diet is clearly implicated. And I think that not only the Canadian Diabetes Association, but the American Diabetes Association came out with a statement saying we, our patients, our members of our association are at greater risk, but that's where it stops. They don't know how to help their patients, or if they do know, they're not telling them. And here's what we know, that if you restrict your carbohydrates, if you, and I'm not saying going on a super low carbohydrate diet, but getting down, what I call is just reversing out of the typical American high carbohydrate diet, but, and particularly getting rid of sugar, refined carbohydrates, but really bringing down those carbohydrates altogether, including even whole grains, will help or even outright reverse those diseases. So just the most stunning example of this I can give you is the largest and longest study on type 2 diabetics that took place out of Indiana University Health. And it went on after year one of a very low carbohydrate diet. The diagnosis of diabetes was reversed in nearly 60% of the population. And people are doing this anecdotally within a matter of weeks just by cutting carbohydrates out of their diets and replacing it with healthy, natural, good fats. Those results, since we all are cynical about nutrition experiments and we think that they don't last and everybody reverts back to the norm, we are all the biggest loser. Those results for the reversal of the diagnosis of diabetes, this is type 2 diabetes if I haven't mentioned that. Mm-hmm. Those results were sustained at year two. Over 50% had still kept their diabetes at bay. So that, you know, not having diabetes, and also these people, there was very significant weight loss. I think it was about 12% of body weight, which is far exceeds sort of the norm on most weight loss studies. And they improved the vast majority of their cardiovascular risk factors. So those people, you know, unarguably got healthier. And there's now, there are over 50 studies now that confirm various aspects of all of these claims about diabetes, weight loss, cardiovascular, improved cardiovascular health on a diet that is lower in carbohydrates, where carbohydrates are lower than 25% of calories. So that should give people a sense of hope. I'm not saying that you won't still catch this disease. People who are really overweight have had diabetes a very long time, very long established heart disease. We are, you know, there's no miracle overnight solution for many people, and I do not want to present this as any kind of false hope. But it is clearly one thing you can do to improve your chances of coming out on the right side of this virus.
Yeah, over certainly. We're talking about what are called comorbidities, and it's not true that coronavirus is simply a merit system. That, you know, if you're healthy and you exercise and you sleep well and you're stress free and you do yoga, whatever, you know, and take, you know, the right vitamins, that you're going to be shielded from the consequences of this, because, you know, there are individuals, relatively healthy young individuals, we don't know that much about their antecedent health history, but young physicians, health practitioners who are exposed in a hospital setting, who got an overwhelming dose of the virus and are on respirators or even have succumbed to it. So, but we can say this, and here's a speculation from Reuters, and you probably saw this, Nina. The headline, why is New Orleans coronavirus death rate 7 times New York's? And the speculation is that obesity is a factor. And we saw this in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, where a lot of individuals down there, you know, deprived of their usual support with medications and medical care and, you know, even simple things like air conditioning, the right kind of food, they died in record numbers, not from the rising waters, but from the consequences of being subject to a little more strenuous circumstances. They were vulnerable, right?
Right, that's correct. So, I mean, there's the people who are, they're generally weaker and less healthy. So there's actually two theories to consider here, that they're less healthy, less able to withstand any kind of assault on them. And we should also just talk for like a minute, just sort of open parentheses here, and specifically talk about how this affects immune health, mm-hmm. and that and what we call the microbiome, which is sort of the health of your gut. Because ironically, the health of your gut is sort of the source of all your immune system health. And if you have a microbiome that is full of healthy bacteria and that is not what's, you don't have what's called a leaky gut, which is not a very appealing term, but this idea that there's leakiness between your gut and your bloodstream. And so that you allow infections to pass into your bloodstream and vice versa. That leaky gut has been known to get worse with sugars, refined carbs, and it has also been known that that people can heal their leaky gut, that is, make it stronger, more resilient, less leaky by reducing those foods, bringing in more healthy, traditional whole foods, natural proteins and fats, and that is where your immune system, that's the heart, the bowels of your immune system. That's where it comes from. But there's another possible theory here, which is that these people who are sick with these metabolic diseases, who have obesity or diabetes or heart disease, they are taking on average 4 to 5 medications for these mm-hmm. diseases. The average American takes 4 to 5 medications.
Yep. The vast majority of people over the age of 50 are at the very least taking a blood pressure medication, if not, you know, more medications for cholesterol, and, you know, on and on it goes.
And on and on it goes. And so an alternative explanation is that, in fact, those medications are weakening the immune system themselves. Something called ACE inhibitors. It's been speculated that they enable the virus to have this particularly lethal effect of sort of exploding into kind of a mega dose of the virus and overwhelm your, you know, a person's system. So I think at this point it's maybe hard to disentangle whether it's the medications or the underlying conditions themselves. But what we do know is that the solution is the same, which is, can you as fast as possible, can anyone as fast as possible try to reverse these conditions and get off medications? I mean, going back to this Indiana University health experiment, the people who had been on this very low carb diet were able to get off 93% of all of their medications, many of them within months. So it's a hopeful story in the sense that there is something that you can do.
It is empowering, actually, because, you know, in the face of this epidemic, which is so overwhelming, we have no plausible cures for it yet. You know, hydroxychloroquine, azithromycin, okay, these things are being explored. They're on the drawing boards, may or may not pan out. But what can we control? This gives us a nexus of control. We can control certain aspects of our lifestyle.
It's true. It is also ironic and sad, maybe a little difficult, that this is maybe the hardest thing to do when you're sitting at home all day long.
Well, some people, I've actually seen some arguments on the internet. You know, the social media is like ablaze, you know, because people have very little else to do. But I've seen arguments like, well, how can you advocate, you know, stringent diet at this time? This is not the time to be talking about this because people are so stressed. They need their comfort foods. Don't burden people with guilt that they're not eating correctly and yada, yada, yada. And I'm going, hey, nothing wrong with messaging about this, because if we couldn't get people to do this to avoid heart attacks and cancer and diabetes and strokes, maybe, you know, we can have a teachable moment around coronavirus and get people to eat healthy to avert that particular misfortune, because it's so clear and present. The other things seem to recede on the horizon. It's like, no, I'm not getting that. We're in denial about these long-term consequences of poor diet.
Right. Well, I would say, and probably what is more stressful, that is stressful. It's stressful being home and having nothing to do. It's more stressful to go to an overcrowded hospital with being sick and infected. But I want to take a slightly different turn on something that you just said, maybe a slightly different angle, which is that it's not that people haven't tried to eat better. I believe that Americans have not tried to improve their eating in order to get healthier, lose weight, avoid heart disease. I mean, if you look at the food consumption according to the best available government statistics that I know of, Americans have increased their fruits and vegetable intake by 25 to 35%. Mm-hmm. They've increased their whole grains. They've decreased sugars since 1999. They've decreased red meat by 28% since 1970, decreased butter by 19%, decreased whole milk by 79%. And so my argument is a little different than most people's, which is that Americans have, I believe, largely done what they're told. But the reason that I got into trying to fix or to do something about our national dietary guidelines, which our nation's most important nutrition policy, is that I believe we've been giving people the wrong advice. Right. So that really, really well-meaning people who have exerted themselves enormously to try to eat well and exercise have just been given wrong advice.
Well, you know, I analogize this, Nina, to the current mask debate. At first they said, you know, don't wear masks. You don't need masks. And the people in the hospital need masks to protect them. And I thought to myself, like, well, if it's protecting them, why shouldn't we be wearing masks? But then I kind of got with the program. And now they did a 180. They said, oh, wait, make sure that you wear a mask anytime that you go out. And so it kind of makes you lose confidence in public health authorities who so deceived us in relationship to the dietary guidelines that many of us dutifully followed, you know, ultra low fat diet, avoid cholesterol, eat less meat. But it turns out that those guidelines were pretty unfounded, weren't they?
Yeah, it's really hard to think of a national policy that has potentially wrought more harm than our nation's nutrition policy. I mean, they were launched in 1980, and their advice was, at the time, eat 7 to 11 servings of grains a day. Right. You know, and at that point, when they were just getting started, they were just like, just eat bread. Just eat a lot of bread.
Eat a lot of Cheerios. Make sure you have, Wheaties. That'll fulfill the guidelines.
Yeah, that currently fills the guidelines. And then put on that, instead of whole milk, which is, the only thing that comes out of a cow naturally and what humans have been eating for millennia, instead use this other product that comes out of a factory called skim milk or non-fat milk and have that instead. By the way, what is the formula for fattening pigs? It's grains and low-fat skim milk. And, it turns out that's it's likely been a very effective way to accelerate the fattening of humans as well. I mean, we were told to shift from natural whole fats, butter and lard, even though that seems like a nasty word, but those were the fats that Americans had eaten and cooked with. So, until the 1920s, for generations and generations, those are the fats we'd cooked with, we'd eaten meat. And so we were told to give up all those foods and instead eat a lot of grains and shift over to industrially produced vegetable oils, mainly mm-hmm. soybean oil. Yeah. And that's just, there's no way to argue against the fact that since the 1980 and the launch of the guidelines, which are, it's a whole point that we could discuss how to, what is the evidence for this, but they have had a huge impact on American eating habits. They have completely changed how we eat, and we have gotten so much less healthy. The obesity epidemic began in the very same year that the guidelines were launched. And it's a remarkable thing. If you go back to movies from the 70s and you look at them and you think, or look at the, go look up the line of people waiting for the yep. opening of the first Star Wars movie. You're just struck. Like, there is not a single person, yep. a single overweight person, obese.
I even go back a little further. We have these archival movies, from the 19-teens, even before the First World War. And they're amazing. They show New York, as it once was. And what you see is you see a lot of amputees, maybe they're Civil War veterans. But it's very rare that you see an obese person. Maybe there's a couple of people pleasantly plump. Maybe the more prosperous bankers have a little bit of a jelly roll around the midsection because they're able to afford more food. But the vast majority of people are pretty lean. And those on a diet where Americans were consuming a lot of beef, a lot of lard, and, you know, and I know that my grandparents and certainly my great-grandparents really prized chicken fat. You know, they didn't skim it off the chicken soup. They stored it and they put it on bread, you know, as a source of sustenance. That's right. What tided them over during those cold Polish winters.
Right, schmaltz,
yes.
Well, and, you know, there's an argument, say, during this time of the Civil War to say, well, people were starving and there simply wasn't enough food and there weren't enough calories. But going back to the 1970s and post-war, the post-war generation, I mean, that was a time of great prosperity. There certainly was plenty of food in the food system, and yet people were not fat and obese. And yet there was not, type 2 diabetes was rare, and there was, you know, no fatty liver disease. There were no children, you know, there were not epidemics of children having, you know, getting cancer. I mean, and I really don't know, and I, in case listeners are wondering, like, I do not know if it's the grains or the totality of them, the amount that we were told to eat, or the way that grains have changed in the way that they're processed, or what's put on them, or it could equally well, or in part, also be due to the fact that when people reduce carbohydrates and go on, you know, if you go out there and look for a healthy low-carb diet through any of the programs that, you know, some of the programs that are out there, they will also tell you avoid industrially produced vegetable oils. That's mm-hmm. part of the program. Mm-hmm. And that comes
consume fats, but don't consume them in those forms because those are synthetic. The body is just not designed to consume those in large amounts.
Correct. Absorb, eat more fat. Don't, you know, do not fear fat. So, but and when you eat fat, eat natural fats, and do not consume these industrial products that, as you say, the body's not designed to consume them. And when they're heated, they create hundreds of oxidation products. And so this knowledge has really come about these industrialized vegetable oils. I would say I have to take a little bit of credit from it. A big part of that was my book. There's also, you know, other people have written on it. But then, so that people who restrict carbohydrates are shifting to natural fats. And so this is a confounding factor that I think can in part influence the results, the very, very positive results that people are seeing on this diet. So, so in any case, those are just two things that tend to go together. And we really, it's hard to separate out the effects of one over the other. But, you know, again, there's now, you know, nearly 100 overall of low carb studies defined loosely or strictly, and they really all show these tremendous benefits. So one of the reasons, I know we want to talk about the dietary guidelines a little bit, but trying to get this idea of carbohydrate restriction into the dietary guidelines seems incredibly important, because one of the ways the dietary guidelines is so powerful is that it's virtually downloaded by every doctor, nurse, nutritionist, dietitian in the land. And so, and it's the basis of hospital food, and it's the basis of food in nursing homes. And so,
the WIC program, the military, you know, the school lunches, et cetera, right?
Everything. And so right now, and it's considered the gold standard, even though upon the most superficial analysis, you will come across some of the worst science that I have ever seen, which is that it's really a very weak scientific document. Still, it is the law of the land. And so so long as we have this one size fits all, high carbohydrates for everyone, including pre-diabetics and diabetics, so long as that exists, we will not be able to get people healthy. And that is why the Canadian Diabetes Association or the American Diabetes Association or any of these groups cannot come out and say, listen, you should all be going on a low carb diet to get your condition under control. In fact, the head of the American Diabetes Association, the CEO, Tracy Brown, came out and said she had cured her own diabetes by going on a low carb diet. Or carbohydrate restriction of some kind. But nobody's allowed to speak those words until the guidelines really change.
Right. And we're going to divide our podcast into two parts as usual. But in part two, I want to talk about your activism, because you're doing something about it. And there's a big push to reform the DGA, the Dietary Guidelines for America, because not only are we facing an unprecedented coronavirus crisis, but that crisis is dwarfed by the daily toll. You know, we're talking 10,000 Americans have died from coronavirus. Well, 10,000 Americans die every week due to diet-related diseases, and they're a substantial proportion of diseases that cause Americans not just to die, but also to have very, very poor health, putting a big burden on our healthcare system for years and decades before they finally expire. Our guest, Nina Teicholz. Nina has been a pioneer in challenging the Dietary Guidelines for Americans, suggesting a lower carb approach. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. We'll be right back.